accession number 19766, Reel 3.
Les Griffiths, Reel 3. You were saying you were wondering what you had.
Well, of course, I was laying there, and one of the heads said to another head, "He's got it. I'm sure he's got it." And then the heads disappeared, and I struggled up the bars of the bars that are around the bed, and I leaned up, and there was a very, very ginger-headed ward chap over there. And I said, "What am I supposed to have got?" "Oh," he said, "malaria." Oh, I didn't know anything about malaria, and I don't think they did either, because malaria wasn't known in this country. No doctors here were familiar with malaria. They are now, but they weren't then.
Were you still aboard ship?
Yes, it was on the ship. This was in the ship, in the sick bay. And 2 days later, Fred, my pal, was wheeled in. He got it as well. So the boss, he went from me to him, I suppose. Anyway. And then, of course, it's all in the, this is in the book, of course, where my stomach, as you are, have you been in hospital for any length of time?
Yes.
You know the problem with the stomach then. You want to go to the loo and you can't. So this ward boy said, "I'll send for somebody." Somebody came in with a bucket and a syringe. He said, "I'll fix you up." So they fixed me up all right, but he said, "You see that door back there?" Well, he said, "As soon as I finish, go through that door, turn left down the corridor, and on the right, you'll find it." And I was out of that door like grease lightning, although I'd been in bed for 5 days. But anyway, I made it. So I gradually got better. As time went on, I gradually began to feel better. Not cured, not by a long, long way, but better than I was. And somebody said, "We've sighted land." I said, "What land is it?" Nobody knew, of course. And if anybody did know, they wouldn't tell us. It was South Africa. So we went round the Cape and up to Durban, where we were put on stretchers and carried out to the... to where you, to, I know what they call the part of the ship where you get off the boat and you go down the plank onto the quayside. So we were lying there in our stretchers, and I was feeling marvellous that day, because you get a good day in with malaria, and I was feeling marvellous looking up. And along come two of our own officers, Jacobs, Lieutenant Jacobs, and Lieutenant, I've forgotten his name now offhand, it's gone. But two of them came up, and Jacobs looked down on me and he said, he was one of the officers I'd seen weeks before about my talking about my father. He said, "How did you do it, Griffiths?" And I looked up, I said, "I don't know," or words to that effect. Anyway, they carried me down. I was carried down like with the others. The others were all carried down onto the quay. We went along the quay to where the ambulances were waiting. And the drivers were girls, or young women. And my first thought, because I was feeling so good, my first thought was, we're in Africa. We knew we were in Africa by then, of course, we'd been told that. My first thought was, well, I'm halfway there. I wonder, is it possible? So I said to the driver, to this girl, I said, "I've got a father who lives in Johannesburg." And she said, probably said, "Oh, yes." I said, "Do you think it's possible for me to get him a note?" Same story. The Boers, the factions of Boers. You can't do anything here. Spies all over the place, that sort of thing. So I said, "Oh, what a shame." So I said, "Anyway, I wrote it down at my father's address on a bit of paper." So I said, "Well, you never know." So here's his address anyway. And she turned out to be from Johannesburg herself. But I didn't know that at the time. I was told that later, although I never saw her after. So this was, I think this was on a Friday, Thursday or Friday. So I gave her the paper with my father's address on it. And then we were whipped away to Springfield, we call it Springfield Holiday Camp, Springfield Hospital, where we were put to bed. and moaned and groaned, of course, because of, you know, the malaria. And on Monday morning, I looked at the door and saw a great big basket coming in, carried on the head of a smallish boy. And behind him was my father. He was carrying a basket of fruit. Well, all the fruits which we, of course, never had here, and had for 2 years. Oranges, bananas, peaches, apricots, all anything you can think of, all in this big, big basket. So that went round the ward twice and then under my bed. And my father. So I said, how did you get here then? You know, I would. He said, I had a message. Let's leave it at that. So, of course, I had a great time in Durban with my father. When I was allowed out, in red tie and hospital blues, I used to meet my father down in Durban. He used to take me for dinner to his hotel. And one of his friends from Durban came up one day with the keys of her car. She said, yeah, here we are, Leslie. She said, here's the keys of my car. Anytime you want it, there's the address. It's all on there for you to find. I said, I can't drive. So there was I with the keys of a motor car in a place like Durban, which we thought was marvellous, incidentally. And I couldn't drive a car. So perhaps it's just as well. But we were in that hospital for about a fortnight, dude, in which time our battalion doctor used to come up every now and then, and he was a pale-faced doctor. He looked as if he should be in there, really. He always looked so sick. And he used to say, well, you'll be with us when we sail. You'll be with us. Don't worry. You'll be with us when we sail. Well, we were worried, of course, but we didn't tell him that. So they sailed, and we were still there. So then we were moved from there. The African medical situation is different from what it is up here, you see. So they sailed away, and we were then moved to Pietermaritzburg to recuperate. And one day I said to Fred, I'm going to put in... Oh, my father had said to me before he left Durban to go back home, don't forget, if you can get to Johannesburg, ask them if you can get a bit of leave, do so. So I said to Fred on one day, I said, I'm going to ask if I can get some leave. So I wrote out a note to the commanding officer of the hospital camp, if I could have 7 days leave to see my father in Johannesburg. Of course, it was taken as a bit of a... It wasn't taken as a true fact of life. Did I do anything to that? No.
No, you're
right. And along came the orderly sergeant very quickly. He said, what's all this? So I said, well, my father lives up there. And I said, I haven't seen him for years, which I hadn't, of course. So I was marched in, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, halt, no, army style, you know. What's all this, private, or what's that effect? And I said, well, I have got my father lives in Africa, and I gave him the address. I said, I haven't seen him for years. Is it possible? He said, 7 days. Make it 14. He doubled it. I had a ticket for train ticket for to overnight. It's an overnight, a long way. Well, through the valley of 1,000 hills. Marvelous. You know, it was great, that part of my service, so to speak. And I ended up in Joburg, where I was met at the station by my father, or my father's wife, his second wife, because my parents had divorced. And I was there for a fortnight, and they gave me a great time. So, as my wife said to me, and it's in the book, I said, it's amazing, isn't it? I said to her one day, I said, 40,000 troops. I said, and I happen to be the one who's got a father in Africa and met him. I said, I still think it's terrific. I mean, it's hard to believe, isn't it, really? And she said, well, God moves in a mysterious way. She said, all in fun, of course. So I put that in the book. Because that's what really happened. So we came back. Eventually, we had to leave there, of course. I came back to Pietermaritzburg. Pick up our kit and Fred, back down to Durban, into a camp down there, and got a boat. Then, oh, my father said, if by any chance you go from here to South Africa, to the Cape, you must see the sunrise over Table Mountain. It'd be early in the morning, but they say it's one of the wonders of the world. So we met, we got talking to one or two of the ship's crew, some of the lads, you know, where we were going. They said they didn't know, and then one day they said, we're going to South Africa. So we said, can somebody wake us early in the morning so that we can see the sunrise? Which they did. And there we were at 5 o'clock one morning, watched the sunrise over Table Mountain. Absolutely out of this world. So, and my father also said, and if you spend any time in Cape Town, he said, you must go on up to Table Mountain. So we stopped in Cape Town. We were there for 5 days. As soon as we got off the boat on the first day we were there, Fred and I inquired as to where the cable car was, which we found. And that was the first cable car I ever went in. I've been in a few in Austria and Switzerland since then, but that was the first. And it was a hell of a thrill, believe me, because you went across over the tops of places, over rocks, as you gradually got towards the cliff face, and then you come to the cliff face, and you had the, you went up, and you were waiting for it to get to the top, and it got to the top, and it, oop, and it humped over, so to speak. Oh, and your heart went back to its normal position, you know. So, we got off. We were probably told what to do and what not to do. I can't remember that. But we wandered around the top, looking down and looking everywhere, and picking flowers. And I picked some of these dried flowers which grow up there. I forgot what they call them now. And I sent them home for my mother. And I got them in the house here. They're in a book here somewhere. Stuck in a book. So I did I thought I was doing the things which I did. I wasn't interested in Cape Town, but I wanted that sunrise, as my father said, and I wanted that cable car, which was brand new to us. A cable car in 1941, terrific stuff, you know. And then we were only there for 5 days, and then we got back on the boat to sleep, and then we were marched off the boat along to some dock somewhere else, to a smaller boat, and I'm annoyed because I can never remember the name of that boat, except that it was a foreign boat which had been captured, you know, that sort of thing. And when we walked onto the boat, I'm almost looking at my book all the time when I say this, because it's all part of the story. We walked onto the boat and we were just milling about because nobody seemed to know what we were supposed to do. The officer didn't know, and there was a great big hold there with a brand new staircase coming up from the, I could see it coming up from the bottom, about 8 feet wide. And I was looking down there and thinking, cat probably carries guns and ammunition and food and all that sort of thing to North Africa, thinking along those lines, you know, it's for stores. And then we got an order from an officer up there who said, right, all you chaps, go down those stairs into that hold. And we looked down the hold and we looked at one another. A hold? So we walked down like sheep, you know. And we stayed down there for about 2 hours. It's sweltering hot, of course. Oh, we played around. Some chaps were playing cards over there, various cards over there. And some of us decided to start a dumb band where everybody plays instruments they don't have. Well, we had one of those, and I was conducting, and old Fred was playing a trumpet, and his teeth fell out. His teeth actually fell. He had false teeth. Fred, do you know he had a tin of steridan in Burma. Anyway, after a while, we thought, this is funny. We're not supposed to be down here, surely. So it was as if we'd had an order from somewhere telling us to get out. So we all rushed up the stairs and out on the deck. We didn't know what we were going to do, but we got out on the deck. We cleared the bottom. No one stayed down. Everybody got out and stood on the deck. And the officers came, no, 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 don't do that, don't do that, don't do this, don't do the other. So now, come on, everything will be all right. Everything's going to be fixed up for you. So walk, you go back on down until we've got things fixed up. And down we went again. So we sat around, waited. And it went on so long and nothing was happening. We all went up again. And this time there were soldiers up there with fixed bayonets. Well, we knew they wouldn't do anything, so we just brushed them aside and walked off the ship onto the quayside. And then we didn't know what to do either. So we were all milling around on the quayside like a lot of sheep. And the officers on the ship were saying, you're going to get into trouble for doing this and doing that and the other. And along came from the far end of the dockside some motor cars. And a chap with braid on his cap and heaven knows what. And it turned out, so we understood, he was the Cape Town chief of whatever they call them. He was a commandant. And he stood up in his car and he said, now you lads, we know what it all means, but Mr. Churchill has said this very day, he spoke something like that, that every ship will have to carry twice as many troops as they've previously been carried. And he was talking like that. And we all looked at one another because we didn't know what to do. He was the commandant talking to us now. So he said, now be a good lot of lads and there'll be no problems. Just walk on board as if nothing has happened and nothing will happen. And we walked up on board just like that. And we walked on the ship, along the deck, down the stairs, and as soon as the last soldier was down the stairs, the hatches came over and the bars went across and we were stuck. We couldn't do it again. We were landed. And the ship eventually started to move, and the appropriate distance out at sea, they opened the hatches, and we were let out. So that was a little episode there. In other words, we mutinied, really. But nothing happened. And the ship, of course, it was a small ship, and I think there probably was double the number of troops on it, of all shapes and sizes, because we were all what they called odds and sods. There was a bunch of us from hospital, there was a bunch of RAF from somewhere else, a bunch from somewhere else, and so on, all a mixed crew. But we always used to see the same chap scrubbing a part of the deck. Tall, thin fellow with a sort of blushed coloured nose, miserable-looking chap. And he was always on what we call jankers, scrubbing the deck. We used to wonder about him. We used to feel sorry for him. And then one night, going across the ocean there, we were told that there was going to be a concert in this particular room. It couldn't have been a vast room because there's only a smallish boat. But there was a window looking into the room. And Fred and I dashed up to the window. And we stayed outside that window probably for a couple of hours before the concert started, because we wanted to see what was going on. We couldn't go in, we weren't allowed in. And who should come forward from somewhere to the piano was this tall, thin fella who was busy scrubbing the decks. It turned out, and he played lovely music. It turned out that he was the pianist in one of the ballet schools in London. Never saw him after that. Don't know what happened to him. But we enjoyed that night. We just slept on deck most of the time after that. Well, I think all the time. Even in the rain, when it rained, we still slept on the decks because we couldn't sleep in that hole in the ship, you know, the hold, until we got to Bombay. And funnily enough, the first thing I can remember of Bombay were the piles of green oranges. I've seen many oranges before, but never green ones, you know. It seemed odd. But anyway, from there we were marched to the huge camp in Bombay, where there was the chap in charge was a Colonel James, and he used to come around on a white horse. I always remember that. And we were ushered into various huts and things. And we were, for a day or so, we could do as we liked, so to speak, but then things got a bit tougher, and we had to do parades and marches and all that sort of thing. until orders came from various parts of India, I suppose, as to who should go where and that sort of thing. And our orders came for us to entrain in Bombay, and we were going to Calcutta.
Who's we now?
Well, the rest of us, myself and Fred, and there was about, as far as I can recollect, no more than about six border men. I can't even remember six, probably four to five border men. And maybe there were other, maybe they were rough for going to to Calcutta as well, I can't remember. But we got onto this train anyway, and away to go. Of course, it was days, it's 1,000 miles away. So we were on the train for days. And the loos, incidentally, was just a hole in one of the floors. You hung on like grim death. But as we went along, every now and then we would stop for some reason or another, for water, for the engine or something. And I used to be sitting by the window looking, and I read the name stamped on the railway lines. Kavartha Works, Merthyr Tydfil, South Wales. Gosh, I lived next door to it. And there were these rails we were travelling on, all made where I came from. Kavartha Works. It had been a famous works during the First World War. They used to make munitions and guns and things there. But they also made rails, obviously, for various countries. And all the way across Calcutta, every time we stopped, I used to have a look, and I saw the name everywhere we stopped. It was Kavartha Works, Merthyr Tydfil, South Wales, you know, that sort of thing. And that was quite something to see, you know, you never expected that. And eventually we got to Howrah Bridge. I can't remember the station now. I've forgotten the station, but we parked ourselves on this station, and we were to wait for we'd get our orders from somebody. By then there was somebody in charge of us, of course. And a train came in. We were here, along here. And a train came in around a bend like that and pulled up here. And the number of Indians, which appeared from nowhere, it seemed, and they all seemed to be dressed in white dhotis. Their dhoti was their thing they wore, like a nightdress. Whew! And they came from all directions, run across the line, onto this train, in the train, out of the train, hanging onto the handles, some on the roof. And away slowly went the train, and it looked, and I looked along as it was disappearing, and it looked like a huge caterpillar, all white. Amazing thing. But where the heck they all came from? They must have been hiding or somewhere, because we never saw that number of people until the train came in. And this was a run across the track, held onto anything. And everything there was an Indian holding on. And that was the first sort of big thing we'd seen. Eventually, vehicles came. They called Garrys out there. Garrys, string of Garrys came along. And we were bunged on, and we went to Fort William in Calcutta. Fort William in Calcutta. We haven't come to the war yet. How many weeks have we got? Good heavens. Where we once again got cracking with our training, you know, we were going to be it, you know, got cracking with our training. One day, after we'd been there a little time, we were then allowed out to go into Calcutta, which was across what they called the Maidan, which is the green open space where the Indians used to play football and all sorts of big games. And we got out of the fort, onto this road, and a white horse with a policeman on it trotted up. And he was up there, he was a big horse, tall policeman. And I said to him, he stopped, he smiled, and Fred and I sort of waved back. So, and I said, which is the best way to get across to the shops, which were over there somewhere, looked a long way off. And he told us, and he spoke, I think, just like I am speaking now, with the same intonation. And I looked up at him and I said, what part of Wales do you come from then? He just laughed. He said, I've been asked that many times. He said, I'm not Welsh. He said, I've never been there. He said, I was born and bred here in Calcutta. And it must be the difference between the dialects. You end up with this dialect, and that one, and you end up sounding like I am sounding now. I was flabbergasted when he said he wasn't Welsh. He sounded so Welsh. Anyway, that was that. Another little incident. Interesting for me, because I never expected that. But so we whenever we could, of course, we used to get out of the fort and go across to the shops and find something to eat, which was better than we could eat in the fort, which was pretty poor. The food was terrible, really. And
you're now with the Ninth Borders.
Oh, yes, we're back with the Borders now. Back with the Borders now, yes. And one day, the monsoons started. We hadn't seen the monsoons before. Now we saw them. And were you in that heavy rain yesterday, was there, or the day before?
Yes.
When it really threw it down? You had about 10 minutes of monsoon. Well, a monsoon goes on for weeks and months like that. Never ceases. It's worth being in one to know about it, you know what I mean? Because people don't realize what it is. Floods everywhere. The gutters couldn't take it, of course. The hotel fronts, and there was Fred and I, sopping wet, and we walked into the Grand Hotel. And we spent hours walking around the place, and nobody said anything to us. We used to go up, walked upstairs, downstairs, just to keep out of the rain. The Grand Hotel, we came to where the ballroom was, and there was a big orchestra playing in there, so we stood by the door and watched. Somebody came up and looked, gave us a dirty look. And said, I said, so I'll be all right in a minute, which shan't be long. And nobody chucked us out. It was great. So gradually we got out, of course, and we had to find our way back to the fort in the monsoon. The time we got to the fort, of course, well, you don't stay. You're only out a moment or two before you're soaked anyway, so it doesn't matter. But that was my first real monsoon experience. But Calcutta was a huge place. All sorts of filth under the sun. The Hooghly, which was a well-known river there, used to float. All sorts of things floated in there. And what do you call the big birds with the...
Vultures.
The vultures. Used to perch on a bridge. In my book, I said they used to perch on the bay, waiting for a body to pass. You know, horrible-looking birds, really, because they had a bare neck, you know. It makes them look worse. And this big beak. And they used to perch on the bridge like that, always waiting for something to float by. And the rubbish. Oh, all Calcutta's rubbish used to be tipped just over there. And there'd be some poor old women over there scrabbling away among it. Oh, terrible, really. And I'll bet it's the same today, you know, after all these years. I bet nothing much has changed, really. But there were lighter sides to it. There were people who British-born people who run factories and things there, or were managers or manageresses of these places. And they used to invite a certain number of troops to their homes on a Saturday. And they would provide sandwiches and food, that sort of thing. Just something different. And they were all very, very nice. Paper mills. We used to go to paper mills, and they'd show us around the paper mill, and then give us writing paper and envelopes and things to come away with. Always, which was very nice, because you needed that sort of thing. So there were the lighter.